Is the end superior to the beginning? And if not, what are we fighting for? Let's consider for a moment. We start with the paper, which we always start with. And this white paper means the absolute power in a state of equilibrium. White is the equilibration of all the colors, and the colors are diversified white light. So the first state we can symbolize by the paper, which is apparently static. The paper is doing nothing at the moment. This statement, the paper is doing nothing, in Indian philosophy is called pralaya, which is the same thing as the Western concept of maximum entropy. Now, the trop in entropy is tropane, to turn. So entropy means in turning, in winding of energy. Now, maximum entropy in science means the state where the energies of manifestation have wound themselves in to their greatest possible degree. That's the maximum degree of in turning of energy. If we imagine all the energies there are in the absolute, and we imagine them instead of turning out from the center and impinging on each other as they might be seen to do, instead of turning out in that way, which is called ectropy, we imagine them to turn in. And in the act of turning in, they're going away from contingent stimulation. So we have entropy and we have ectropy. A few years ago, science used to talk a lot about maximum entropy and say that ultimately, you can find this in extant books of science now, ultimately all the energies of the universe, or universes, the multiverses, would wind in and go into a state of equilibrium. And that when that state was reached, all would become static, cold, lifeless. Now, there was a bit of bad philosophy behind the statement, because if that were true, and there had been infinite time before us, the laws of probability say that maximum entropy should already have been reached before now, and we should have wound up. We should have turned all the energies in, and the thing should be static. Now it is not. And yet we have an infinity of time before us. And given an infinity of time before and after, the law of probability says that this entropy state must be reached, given infinite time, which we have both before us and behind us. Therefore, it is observed that it's very probable that while the energy is winding in one center, it may be winding out from another center. So it was then postulated that for every zone of entropy, there is another zone of ectropy. For every zone of interning of energy, there's another zone where the same energy that is winding into one place is winding from another place into it. Now, the question is the last state superior to the first state or not? When we say, imagine the paper to be still, and this paper is the white, the equilibrated absolute, when we, as finite beings, imagine, that is, make an image or picture of the paper as static, what does it really represent? Does it represent absolute energy in a static condition? Or does it represent an abstract idea of a possibility that in certain zones within the absolute there might be a static condition? We have to say this, that we cannot imagine the absolute at all, because to image means I, Marg, is the same as I make, except the K becomes G, so the Mac or Spock, the same Mac in the Immaculate Mary, is made into a gross material being in the word imago. In the image, the form or idea, the substance M, the energy R, and the inhibiting function K, the map, that idea becomes grossly established, which means that the energy becomes very tightly packed. Now, if we say an image of the absolute, we're talking nonsense immediately. Because the word absolute means away, washed. Ab and the solute. Now, something is being solved away. In the concept of the absolute, what we solve away are all finite considerations whatever. All forms, all continued relations, everything of the finite is washed away in the concept of the absolute. That being so, we cannot make an image of the absolute. And therefore, we cannot say that the absolute is static, because the concept of the static is the concept of forces, finite, pressing upon each other. There are no static entities other than systems of opposing forces, stabilizing in their opposition, which is the thing you're supposed to do when you say your prayers. You put your hands together and hold them together, and this holding of the hands together should remind you of the opposition, the polarity in the universe and in your own organism. And you know, very often when kiddies are saying their prayers, they can't hold them together, so they lock the fingers and try and get the fingers to hang on to each other. If you actually put your hands together and then forget about them, they start drifting apart. So it's a method of stimulating the memory to put your hands together symmetrically without any hanging on of thumbs or fingers to aid them. And that helps you to say, am I remembering myself, my polarity, the opposition between my will and my intellect? I put them together, I hold them together. From this continuous remembering of the opposition comes reflexive self-consciousness. And the word static is made of the root star, which is the same in stand, and another C, and the glyph of fixation again. Now, this S in static means the life force itself. It's the original serpent, not with tail and mouth, free. It is an undulation of absolute energy. It is not closed. When it comes onto the T, T symbolizes where two forces meet. So there is an establishment, establishment. And where those forces strike, the energy rotates. So unless we have forces in opposition, we cannot bring anything whatever into existence. And when we do so, we are making the situation static only by feeding into it energies that oppose each other. Now, contraction, the traction means drawing. Drawing together. If energies draw together, then it contracts and it contra-acts. That is contra-action in contract. Just if you open your palm, the fingers do not contradict. They do not speak against each other. If you close them and bring them into contact, that is, they act together by touching each other, in that moment of con, you are drawing together, draw, tract, with, con, contract. Bring them together, they oppose each other, and this opposition can make the static position of your fingers. You press upon them with equal force, and then they are held in the static relation. So the static refers to the finite energies in opposition. And therefore, the static cannot refer to the absolute. This means that when we image this paper and say it represents to us the absolute, it is really just a symbol. And we must get rid of the paper. Once we have said it symbolizes the absolute, we must then get rid of the paper and retain the concept that the absolute is an equilibrating power absolutely. But Finitely, we've said nothing whatever about it. We've said it is power because it is the absolute cause of all relative events. But of itself, we can say nothing whatever finite. And static refers to finity, and therefore we cannot say it is static. And the opposite of static is dynamic. And therefore, the absolute must be conceived in a peculiar way to be dynamic. Now, it is power, it is energy, it is force. And when we consider the inwinding, immediately we make a locus, a place, a topos. And when we have done so, we have immediately finited our concept and we've let go of the absolute for the time being. When the energy is conceived by us to wind into one place, we can say, if we like, that it becomes potential as opposed to actual. If it winds in completely, it ceases to act upon another sensor we will call the observer. But that same energy that's in winding, by definition, could wind out. And if it winds out again, that is entropy. It would then begin to impinge on other centers, which may be inward. So, throughout the absolute, we have to conceive that all that we mean by place, by locality, all that is headed under topography, all those things, we must say, are somehow functions of absolute power. Now, the totality of patternings of these inwound energies constitutes all our geometrical propositions. And when they're inwound, they occupy zones and constitute, in a peculiar sense, a substantial universe governed entirely by inertia. Inertia means inward. The same thing, the entropy, is to be thought of as inertia, that is inworking. The inturning is the inworking. So wherever we have a finite structure, whether it's a triangle or a square, we must think if it exists, there must be rotating energies inside it to fill it up. Large groups we would call molecules, smaller ones, atoms, primary particles, and so on. We go down to very, very tiny little rotations of that force to the tiniest conceivable subatomic functions there are. But while we're doing so, we are not thinking about the absolute. We're thinking about a finite zone. But when we think about the absolute, we must say it is that in which all these things are and in which all these things coexist. And that in which there can be no possible application of the concept of separativity. Separativity refers to the finite. And the finite is a product of the inwinding of energies to create centers. When those energies are inwound to create centers, then individual existences have come to be, whether human, animal, vegetable, or mineral, whether atomic or subatomic. They are individuated zones of inertia. And as soon as we circumscribe them, we are talking about a finite. We are not talking about the absolute. Now the question is our final condition, our big O, our omega, better than our alpha? And here we can say yes and no simultaneously. It's a pair of opposites. Let the white paper again symbolize the absolute. Let this entirely abstract concept of the static be applied to it for a moment, illegitimately. Let us say we are imagining the paper to be static and that it represents the equilibration of absolute force. But we know that the term static cannot be applied to it. And nevertheless, let us apply it to it in order to clarify this fact. But when we think about equilibrium, we think about finite forces opposed to each other. And these finite forces pressing on each other keep each other in being by their opposition, and that makes it static. Now, this is not the alpha. No matter how big a complex of forces may be, it is not the alpha. the alpha, our letter A, the Greek alpha and the Hebrew aleph, they symbolize the non-manifest, the non-differentiated, the non-finite. They symbolize the absolute prior to any concept, whatever the finite being. Now this alpha is already an abstract idea as we're talking about it. It is not the concrete or grown together whole. And consequently, we have to say about it that it is the absolute beginning of all things. It is not the head of the series, that is the letter B. The B in being. The B in the first word in Genesis, the Bereshit, which means bara. The bara means in that house there will be differentiation. So we have A, and then we have B. And the A is the breath, the first sound the baby makes when it cries. It is R. And that breath comes out of the child without obstruction. But when it closes its lips, it says B. And so after it said R, when you smack it when it's born, later on it will discover it has mobility, compressibility, self-opposition in the lips, and it will put the top and bottom lip together, and by contraction, contradiction, contraction, it will say B. And therefore it will be the point of circumscription where there will be brought into being for it finite concepts. So that B is the head of the finite series, but R or A is the absolute head. R corresponds with the theological concept of the Godhead, must be correspond to the theological concept of the assumed Mary or the son in his own house. This is the Ben or son. Now, let us remember, we want to know if the Alpha is inferior to the Omega. We know that the mere fact that we isolate these two things shows something peculiar about it. We've already indulged in an abstraction. The absolute itself, in its full concrete significance, not as an abstract idea, but as the concrete whole of all actuality, whatever, that absolute cannot be improved upon. So that when we refer to it, we must now assume that this white paper is not static, it is power, and that this power is vibrating. The vibrations are too fast for you to see. We know that the molecules of the paper are vibrating. We know the atoms and the subatomic particles and the electrical charges that constitute them are all vibrating. So although the physical human eye cannot see the movement of the constituents of that paper, nevertheless we know that those motions are there. So now we'll have a look at the difference between R and O and see whether O is superior to R. The first thing we observe about it is this. There is a circumscription in the R plus two legs. And in the O, this thing is circumscribed and the legs are not drawn. Well, if you want to write this thing with the Greek alpha, or with an old form of the A, inverted, the opposite head, we see again that in fact R is O plus. So that in the diagram, R is not less, but more than O. Let's see why. The two horns on the inverted letter A symbolize the dialectical functions of spiritual power itself. One of them symbolizes idea, that's the one on the sinister side, and the other one symbolizes will. There is will and there is idea. That is to say, in power as dynamic, we view two aspects. One, the volitional aspect, whereby the power wills form. And the other is the form itself, which is willed, And the form is a restriction self-imposed by the absolute. Form, as you can tell, the idea, the D tells you there's a division, just as the R and the F in form tell you there's differentiation. So one horn means the power or will aspect, and another horn means the form or idea aspect of the absolute. But these aspects are not to be separated out from each other. They are seen to be aspectual only and not separated. And yet somehow this will winds itself in, circumscribes itself, isolates a zone of power, and makes an idea. The idea it has made is a form. But the form is only the form of the will, the mode of its operation. So there's no division whatever between the will and the idea, because the idea is an exact expression of the will that makes it, because it is that will there formulating in that way. Now we have a trinity here. We've turned the letter A upside down, and we've seen that it represents two horns and one circle. Now, the circle resolves the opposition between the will and the idea. And observe again the danger of abstract thinking. We know that the belly is more urgeful than the head. And we know the head has more ideas than the belly in manifestation. But the peculiar thing is that down at the bottom end of the body, there's a little thing looking suspiciously like an omega, which contains seeds. There's a bag there, and inside that bag, little seeds are made. And those seeds are contained in a thing, the outline of which is the omega, the big O. And all the seeds are the contracted potential forms of the absolute. And they are in the man. Now the fact that they have contracted into it, that's entropy, they've wound into it, means that they can wind out again. When they wind out into manifestation. Now we remember that no body, no person, no consciousness ever knows anything other than the modifications of its own substance, and cannot do so. Therefore, we can say immediately that when that absolute energy appears as spermatic energy in a man, when it is being a sperm, because the sperm modification is what the consciousness knows in that place, all it knows in the sperm form is what it's like to be a sperm. It doesn't know yet what it is like to be a zygote or an embryo or a baby. Those things are potentials inwound in, which are not yet wound out. But the totality of all that may wind out is already in. And nothing can come out except that which has gone in. So as nothing can appear from it that has not gone into it, well, as we say, there is no evolution without a previous involution, then the evolved state and the involved state must be exactly equal and opposite. So that it appears that the beginning and the end are identical in one respect, in one aspect. But if that is so, what is the good of struggling? Now, somewhere on an early tape we have a statement: the spirit never got lost, the body cannot be saved, therefore, what does salvation mean? And we said it means realization that the spirit can't get lost and the body can't be saved. This is a very important point, because otherwise we struggle unintelligently to release something which cannot be released, and we're in a state of identification where something that has never been bound believes that it is bound. The spirit, the absolute, cannot be finited, and the finite can never become absolute. So what does salvation mean? It means realizing that the whole problem is one of identification. D Do you identify with the absolute, you are free. Do you identify with the finite, you are bound. It is identification that does it. Now, if the involution and the evolution are exactly equal and opposite, then it appears that there's no improvement. But we've already seen that a pair of opposites are both equally valid. And they always presuppose behind them that it has polarized itself in this opposite manner. So the absolute which stands behind this polarization is greater than both, and yet cannot manifest without using both. Now, if we say here is the Alpha and here is the Omega, the beginning and the end, we can see immediately a peculiar thing about it. They're exactly equal and opposite, and yet they are only aspects of something that has never yet appeared in a polarized state. And that which does not and cannot appear in a polarized state is the absolute as such. It is the absolute, absolutely, that is the absolute, not polarized, but prior to the concept of polarization. Now, it's obvious that we're short of a term. We write A for the beginning of the alphabet, or in English we write Z, in Hebrew we write T, and so on, Tau. And A is the head, absolutely, and B is the beginning of the time process, and it goes along in its development through the various modalities symbolized by the letters. But this A has a double significance. It has the significance not only of the absolute head, which also has the significance of that internal to which the B appears. So now we have to draw the letter A and look for the letter B in it. But we already said that the letter B originally used to be a circle, and that this circle symbolizes whatever can be circumscribed or finited. And this finiting process is what we mean by manifestation, the universe that can be known by the sense organs. Now we look for that in the letter A, and we find quite simply that the body of the letter A, apart from the legs, or in its invert form, the horns, the body of the letter A is the letter B. That is to say, we can draw this and say this is a kind of chalice. That's the horns of the sign of the ram. And this we put inside it is the cosmic sphere, which is being itself. So the letter A really means AB. It means the absolute head as a free vowel, and it means the head of a series as a consonant B. When we now say, is the Omega superior to the Alpha, we say immediately, no. It is exactly the same, and yet, behind this opposition Alpha-Omega, there is a super-Alpha that really has polarized itself as itself and other in the polarization Alpha-Omega, where the one thing that retains its identity throughout the whole process is the absolute, which cannot change. So this mysterious Alpha appears through the whole thing. In other words, it is the absolute breath that is needed to pronounce every other letter. That is, you can't pronounce the letter B without your breath. So that when B appears, it is only Alpha acting upon itself and constricting itself to pronounce the B. And when it goes to its term called the Omega or Big O, it is simply still the Alpha, the same Alpha, which is now substantialized, that's the M function, and it is grossly objectified, that's the Ga function, and it is circumscribed, that's the O function. So it says O, circumscription, big substance, grossly established. Now that big O is simply the modal behavior of alpha carried to its term. But alpha is not a static, not a finite, and therefore all the things that might appear in the time process as problematic, separate, serial problems subsist inside the alpha as pure actuality. They are not potentials in alpha. To and for the alpha, they are actualities. And therefore God is said to be pure act. He is not a potential God. He's an actual God. But the finite who is brought to be by the inwinding process and is acted upon by the outwinding process of another, that finite identified with has a problem of what is the relation between its ground, the alpha, and itself, carried to its term, its omega. So the omega is the big O, the cosmic O, the cosmic self, the cosmic Lord, the cosmic Christ, the cosmic Adam. This cosmic being, the biggest circle that we can conceive, is the omega, and it is only the alpha which is there, modalized itself in that form. So in that sense, there's a peculiar superiority absolute for the alpha, because it is actually on these perfected forms. And yet there is a process going on inside it, the totality of the elements of which constitutes perfection, that any single element or group of elements identified with constitutes a problem. And the problem for the individual is then, how do I become omega, and is it worth it if alpha is already actually there? And the answer is, if alpha is seen to be absolute actuality and not a potential, then it is seen that alpha is really omega, but that the individual is striving to get back to the source, the alpha in himself, and that alpha is pure actuality, immediacy, simultaneous experience of its total element. If it gains this simultaneous experience of the actuality of alpha, it is omega in itself. So that peculiarly, the alpha and the omega are identical when viewed as a pair of opposites. The alpha is absolutely superior because the omega is only a function of it, and yet the omega is a necessary function of it, because only in it is the totality of the actual possibilities of the alpha realizable in a form. This form being one of self-contraction, self-contraction, self-contradiction, or the dialectical process internalized in any finite. Is that clear? For a moment, it's the seamless whole that we're talking about, and anything the paper does, if it moves in one part, it necessarily alters the tension systems in all parts. If we now arbitrarily draw certain circles upon the paper and say, let us pretend what is obviously not true, that the paper inside the circles is separate from the paper in another circle or outside the circle. And that is the belief of individuals. The man who is identified with the limits of his own perceptual body, in the fact of identification, is committed to fend for himself as a finite. If he does so, he must start hitting against other beings or trying to rope other beings in to his purpose. If he does so, because there are other zones of the paper, he is in effect trying to fold the paper up. He's trying to make all the other circles become circles laid upon himself. And this is a very natural response, but it is also one that is doomed absolutely to fail. The attempt on the part of any individual to dictate to another individual is doomed to fail for the simple metaphysical reason. The individual is an arbitrarily demarked zone, and the thing upon which the mark is drawn, the paper, is the symbol, is continuous with all other paper in all circles and beyond. So that if one of these moves, they all move. And if one of these tries to make all the others congruent with it, in other words, it tries to fold their energies into itself, it is taken on that impossible job, the reduction of the infinite into the finite. Now, all the energy in the world depends on identification with finite and ignoring the fact symbolized and put into an imperative form, love your neighbor as yourself. It does not mean as if he were another being like you are. It doesn't mean another being at all. It means what it says. Yourself. Now, when any arbitrary circumscribing line is looked at, and you see inside that line the paper, and that paper correctly is the self, absolutely. Therefore, the self that you think about when you think about the consciousness in yourself is exactly the same as any other self in any other body. Whether it's the consciousness in a plant or an animal or locked up in a stone, it is the same consciousness. And if you say, all right, this consciousness is the same, and therefore when I act on this particular body, I necessarily act on all bodies, because the body is a modality of the consciousness. The consciousness knows only the modifications of itself. So that this particular body, which I tap now, is just one of the modalities in an absolute continuum called the self with a capital S. But that is the self you refer to if ever you refer to your consciousness as such, and not to a form of experience recorded in your memory. Recorded in your memory, there is a very simple thing, nothing more than the clashings of contingent stimuli, mutual irritation. The forms of those disagreements, those contradictions, those stimuli, recorded, constitute your formal individuality, the thing that you refer to when you identify with your body. But that is not consciousness, that is a modality of and in the consciousness. But if you identify with the consciousness and not the body, then you immediately gain all consciousness there is. And you can legitimately say that all the other bodies in the room or in the world are yours, because you are referring to that self. And this does not mean that you can, with your physical body, order the other bodies about. That would be a misconstruction. It means that this conscious level which you have now reached, the level of the absolute, sees all bodies within it as functions of it, and that there is only this one supreme, seamless self. Now, if that is remembered, there are no problems of relation. You can't start to fight with another body if you know that you're not a body. It is just not conceivable that you would do it. Why should you do it if all these bodies belong to this one self, and this one self is working in all bodies to express the potentials of their relations? And if you identify with that absolute self, all you can do is go on working for the ultimate development of the potentialities of all relational possibilities of all the bodies there are. Now, as soon as you let go of this seamless self that runs through all things, and which makes all the modalities called individual bodies of all kinds, minerals, vegetables, animals, humans, angels, and whatever, once you let go of that seamlessness, you identify with the finite body. In doing so, you've done yourself one in the eye, the ego eye, because you have in fact identified with a finite system of engram memory patterns, which, because it is finite, has only finite application. In other words, identification with the physical body produces ignorance of all the things not contained in that particular body, which means that as soon as you identify to defend yourself, you know less than you need to defend yourself. Hence Christ's statement, if you try to preserve your life, you will lose it. Let's look for a moment to see. Here are two beings. They both have a nuclear center that functions directly from the absolute, and it does so immediately. But because of the inwinding and rotations of energies in each place, although the seamlessness of the paper is not destroyed, there are functions, modalities of power of that seamless, which bring into being apparent finite entities. And these apparent finite entities can hit upon each other's perimeters. They cannot hit on each other's centers, because they are not a plurality of centers. The center of every being is the original white paper before it is drawn. Now, where they can hit upon each other, there arises the contingent stimulus, the stimulus with touch. And we find that it specializes in our organism into five special organs against a general feeling or sentience, the quality of the protoplasm. And it has a coordinator called the common sense, which coordinates the messages of the five senses. And also, between these five senses going in and the energy from the center coming out, there arises the double triangle or six-pointed star, which is not the common sense, but the sense of the dialectical opposition of polarity in being itself. And this we call the intellect, purely. And the other one, the common sense, is what people normally mean by mind. If they say, oh, that fellow's got a good mind, normally they don't mean he's got a pure, balanced intellect able to see the polarized functions of the universe. They mean that he's fairly well stocked with knowledge through the five senses. So if a fellow goes to the appropriate brick building and acquires some knowledge, and then later, from his memory, throws the knowledge out again, some bright wit will say he has a good mind. It simply means that he has had engrammed upon him certain formal stimuli which have left records in him, which on the appropriate stimuli replay like a tape record. That does not mean intelligence, it means mechanical response. And it is no proof when a person has managed to get a BA failed that he's a brilliant fellow when his memory is so stopped. But inside this common sense, a little deeper, is the zone of the intellect. And the intellect is only concerned with yes and no, with for's and against, with this, not this. It is concerned with polarization, with opposites. And therefore it thinks in pairs of universal ideas. And it is this intellect that makes the analysis. This thing is worth doing, this thing is not worth doing, according to the purpose within. But right inside, deeper than the intellect, is the essential self, which is the paper, unspoiled by any finite modification whatever. Soon as a person externalizes his attention, lets go of his center, identifies with the sense organ, and receives a stimulus from another being, and concentrates upon that stimulus, as in listening or looking or tasting or smelling or touching. When he does that, if he does it for one sense only, he has made himself four-fifths ignorant at the sense level. Simply to finance, if you like to do it experimentally, you listen very, very carefully to the sound of the motors in the tape recorder. At that moment, you will find you're not smelling the paint on the wall, or you're not looking at the colors of the curtains. to concentrate, to identify with one sense, is to become four-fifths ignorant at the sense level. And not only four-fifths ignorant at all of this, but much more, because you become infinitely ignorant as soon as you concentrate on any finite whatever. There's not only the five specialized sense organs, there's a general sensitivity in the protoplasma as such, and there's an absolute sentiency in your center. With what you identify, with that shall you be informed. So if you identify with one particular sense, you'll become ignorant on four other senses. Try it, and you'll find it is so. It is extremely difficult to smell something cooking and decide what it is, whilst at the same time and with the same amount of concentration, you listen to a piece of Beethoven on a record. As you concentrate on the other tends to disappear. And this is a temporal function of using the sense organs at all, because they are specialized for serial purposes. But you have a generalized awareness whereby you can actually, without concentration, by decentration, you can become aware of a nice piece of Beethoven and a frying vegetarian chop or something, and get the meaning of both of them simultaneously. And beyond this, there's an absolute sentiency in which all the separable functions of the time process are simultaneously co-experienced. And this is the absolute objective experience of the alpha omega identity prior to its polarization. That is the significance of the Buddhist Nirvana, which is the significance of all enlightenment in any religious concept at all. But quite suddenly, instead of seeing things separately, and then it's a seeing things will be divine science. Instead of seeing things separately, you see them coherently, simultaneously, and thereby get their significance. Whereas as soon as you listen to a finite and try to solve its meaning from itself at the finite level, you've wasted your time. So peculiarly, the alpha, which is the absolute origin of all things, has within itself the being called the omega, the bigger, the cosmic. And this is in itself as an actuality. So that the problem of whether to become alpha or omega is not a problem for alpha or omega. It is a problem for a man identified with a finite zone within the omega. And this is a problem for nobody else. The thing is problematic because of identification. Break the identification and it is felt, seen, and known in its absolute fullness that alpha and omega are not two separate things, one superior to the other, and that nevertheless the alpha is absolutely superior to all its modifications and to all abstract ideas which are taken from it, drawn away, solved, washed away from this absolute. The absolute is absolutely all. When we say less than the absolute, we are saying something particular. And the particular is already an abstract idea, although it looks concrete. It looks concrete because it acts upon the five senses. And the absolute appears to be non-existent because it doesn't act on the five senses. It acts on itself, being absolutely the only reality there is.
So this problem can't be seen at all within
The problem is set as a problem in the time process.
Using serial thought, it can't really be solved.
Can't be solved. The solution is outside the time process. The solution is by the cessation of serial thought. And then we come back to rule one, holding up in the paper. If you can get your mind into that state defined in yoga, ekacitta, one mind, which corresponds exactly with what Christ meant when he said, if the eye be single, the whole body is full of light. Now this obviously requires the contraction of all your thought processes into the primary punctum, the Yod, which is the hand of God, the executive power, folded into a unity, and it is not allowed to serialize. Now, when you get hold of your mind and you destroy serial thought without falling asleep, you hold this unific awareness in yourself, and you don't allow it to move. At that moment, there is no problem, and you know exactly what Alpha in relation to Omega is. And then you have transcended the problem, and we come back to a very early statement we made here, that no problem of the time process is ever solved. Problems cannot be solved, they can only be transcended. You climb to another level, and that was problematic down there, is no longer problematic. And as long as it's problematic, the level on which the problem appears is the level on which it cannot be solved.
What is the final problem of the time process?
The final problem of the time process was reduced to what is the significance of the phenomena of change of place. And this you can see physically by doing a very simple exercise. Supposing you look at another person and you attend, say, to his left ear. Suppose again, I look at your left ear. Now, I'm aware that you have eyes and a nose and mouth. I'm looking at your left ear. Your left ear is now the focal centre of my vision, but I know you've got your hand on your chin. And that is what we call marginal awareness. I keep my eye focused on your ear, but I'm aware that there is war and there is a void here. I can feel there's a war right behind me. I can hear by the echo quality what's going on. Now, what do I actually do to shift my awareness from the ear to the wall? What do I do? Can you feel it? Quite simply, we say, I alter my attention. That is, I am such a being that I can tense here, or I can tense here, or I can tense here. And I have an infinity of tension points inside myself, any one of which I can increase. And when I increase one above the level of the others, I'm then said to attend, that is to tend towards, and to hold attention at that place. Now there is no other problem with the time process other than attention. As soon as you make a finite tension, the process of time has started. Mm.
This is the basis of identification carried on from
this, isn't it? Precisely. If the Sophic sphere, the totality of all actual forms in the infinite, is seen in its totality, there is no time. Therefore, in the Book of Revelations, it says, and there will be time no more, and sea shall be done away with, and there shall be no more sea. A sea is the glyph for the substance modulation, as substantial, that is, as inertia. Whereas, in this absolute state, where there is no time, and time is emission of energy from point to point, or tension, and those tensions, the finites and particulars, are let go of, then you enter into that absolute awareness, which is above time, and contains all the former elements that were serialized in time, and is simultaneously presenting as the wonder eye and the absolute. But this I, the absolute, knows all its actuality and all its forms within itself, simultaneously, concretely, and it twinkles to itself. That is to say, it can tense throughout itself simultaneously all its forms. And this tension that occurs simultaneously throughout it is the cause of what is called the absolute equilibrated light, where from each point in the absolute, attention is made and spreads out from all other points. So there's a continuous twinkling in the Wunder Eye. And that being simultaneous instead of serialized is non-temporal. But it gives the key to the understanding of all the temporal things. Other stumbling blocks, if you get it.
at the seam of the garment in one of the miracles, a woman touches the hem of the garment.
First of all, first a hem is a garment, isn't it? Now this garment symbolizes the seamlessness of the Absolute, and therefore power. And therefore it says that power went forth from him when she touched this. She is a finite being. That it is a she who is a will. And this will says, I am not good enough to touch the man. The very center of the Absolute. If I can just get to the perimeter of the seamless and hold that, some of its power will come into me sufficient for my need. And as soon as one gets hold of that hem, it's an HM function. It is a peculiar thing where she's identifying a pair of opposites. Because she says, if I can touch this mere garment, somehow absolute force, which is no mere garment, can come to me. So somehow with this M I get an H. Because there is no M other than a function of H. So if in fact a finite person believing that if they come into contact with something, no matter what it is, whether it's a piece of wood or a fetish, an idol or a plaster cast of a virgin, whatever it is, if they believe that this is symbolic of the Absolute, it then constitutes for them a hem of the seamless whole. And in the belief, as they touch it, not the thing itself, but the Absolute that they have in themselves, feeds energy through that concept. And thus they get the benefits of the will to touch. And she has a definite aim. All she wants is curing of what is wrong with her. It's quite finite. She's not committing herself to this, she's told absolutely. Remember on one occasion that Christ cured a row of lepers, and only one came back and said thank you. So that when they go for their benefits, they're not permitted to obey God absolutely to others and persons. They've gone for a specific benefit. And that doesn't matter, God isn't bothered about that. In fact, he's not being others at all in any way, because he's seamless. But when they go for a specific benefit, they get the benefit they go for. And it says, ask, seek, and knock. Now, ask with your heart, with your feeling. You seek the means thereto with your mind, and you knock with the power, the basic power. If you do those three things, then you must receive a reply. It is impossible to be rejected if you do those three things. Because you have said, ask, that's to feel the awareness. With your feeling, you say, I feel. You're quite sincere. You're not trying to pull somebody's leg on the outside. And you're determined not to pull your own leg. You're just feeling the seamlessness. Then you seek with your intellect. You escape it. You define exactly what you want. You keep your field awareness, and then you define exactly what you want. When you've defined it, then with your will, you knock against that Absolute. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. As you hit with your will is itself the Absolute energy at the point where you are conscious. It hits, in other words, against itself. It starts a reverberation of its own power within it. And according to the definition given in the seeking, and the identification with the field, so is to feed back onto the center of the will.
You say that the woman goes with a perfect, a finite perfect, and because she goes with that perfect is fulfilled to her, but God is not bothered. By which you mean to imply that she is bound to go more, isn't it?
Well, she's bound to go again if she gets filled. She'll ask for more.
But she only gets what she
asks for. Yes, definitely.
She never gets more
than
she
wants.
Only the need to ask for more.
After the satisfaction she gets, she will breathe more. She'll ask for more. But it won't be what she doesn't ask for. So that when she touches the hem of the garment, it does not turn around and say, now you have that, I hereby confer upon you universal enlightenment and full responsibility. But she said, well, please take back when they gave their spending time. It's not a purpose. And it isn't God's purpose to make a finite being have a purpose if they're not ready. Because when Christ goes to John the Baptist and says, baptize me, and John the Baptist says, no, I'm not fit to do it. Christ replies, do it, because thus it becomes to fulfill all righteousness. That the superior should be baptized by the inferior, so that nothing is left undone. Because otherwise there'd be a possible remaining merely a potential. Somehow this absolute has to come down to the level of baptism in a material world which has itself finite in, and which is by being finite powerless. And yet somehow this thing has to come down and do this deed. So that when Christ goes to John the Baptist and says, baptize me, and John says, well, it's no good, you can baptize me. And he says, nevertheless, do it. I know you can't do it, but do it. Because the inferior must be prepared to baptize the superior. Because to every action there's an equal opposite reaction. And the absolute, in all its absoluteness, is exactly balanced by the relative, in all its relativity. So the absolute, the God, goes to the finite relative, John the Baptist, and says, I will come into your water in order to fulfill all righteousness. Now in the same way, when this woman asks for her little cure, she gets it, and no more than she asks for, because she has her own order of learning. She has her own way of learning the same lessons that everybody else has to learn in other ways. And it would be quite wrong to give her a lesson she's not asked for, because asking means opening. She opens one kind of door, and he makes it a triangle. When you allow filling, it is a square. It's not filling, it isn't satisfactory, it's excessive. Or it's too small a square. It certainly isn't right. And according to the precipitation of the time process, and by the finiting nature of serialization, no two finite beings can ask the same question at the same time in the same way. And so everyone should be, and is by the absolute, given that for which they ask and no more. But because they have asked and been satisfied, they'll come again with a slightly modified request. And it's the ability to see this and to refuse to reject oneself. One cannot be rejected by the absolute, because one is internal to it and is a modality of it. But to identify with oneself because of bad choices, bad requests, to say, I'm not fit to ask any more. That would be a fundamental error. It would say, by identification, I'm no good. Why? Because I've always been no good. That's a temporal thing. It's the devil's chief weapon, if you like. The principle of differentiation, the denial of the seamless garment, says, if you commit an error, you're stuck with it. There is no forgiveness for you. You have done it. You're that kind of being. You're no good. Therefore, you might as well accept yourself as no good. All that is identification and self-justification by egotism. And the identifying being is always, by its very nature, self-justifying, because every energy system is straining to equilibrate itself. The equilibration is self-justification, because justification means balance. So that every being that commits an error, every finite being committing an error, must, if it is identified with the finite, do whatever it feels to be necessary to balance itself, regardless of the truth or untruth of what it does. And therefore the attempt at self-justification by an individual is always doomed to failure. Whereas, once it is seen that the individual is a modality only of the absolute, then immediately a man is justified. Now this is a justification by faith, because in fact, the finite, identified person cannot see his justification within the absolute. But if he can grasp at it a little bit and see the possibility that the totality of all possible temporal forms of all times, places, past, present and future, the totality of all these must add up to an equilibrated whole. Must do. And therefore, whatever a being is doing at a given cross section of the time process, it is exactly balanced at that moment in its totality. So the justifying or balancing of the whole is an absolute fact. And the moment that one feels absolutely justified and is balanced by the absolute, then one ceases to struggle to justify oneself. And when one does not try to justify oneself as an individual, then a whole series of self-defense tensions disappear. When they disappear, you can see more. In other words, you actually start becoming as just as you have felt yourself to be, justified. And so the mysterious acts of the justification by faith can be seen to be absolutely rational.